from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, local journalist and author Nancy Mullane takes up the question of whether murders can be redeemed. In her new book, Life After Murder, Mullane follows the lives of five men convicted of murder who served long sentences at San Quentin Prison and were then released. And she'll join us for the hour ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this hour of the Forum program. Bay Area-based journalist and author Nancy Mullane joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. Her feature stories have been on PRI's This American Life, NPR, and local San Francisco NPR affiliate KALW. In 2009, she received a Soros Justice Media Fellowship, and in 2011, she was awarded a National Edward R. Murrow Award. Her book, Life After Murder, Five Men in Search of Redemption, tells the stories of five convicted murderers sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole and the fights each man had in trying to live a worthy life. And welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michael.
Good to have you here. We were talking, as I guess you heard maybe in the green room, about the decision by the Supreme Court on the provision, on life without parole for juveniles. And we kept talking about how there's a difference in young people and their brains. I mean, the research seems to bear this out very strongly. They're more impulsive. They're less rational. Their brains are less developed. And their behavior, therefore, it's assumed, is more possibly geared toward reform. This is one of the big lessons I got from reading your book, that these are people who committed crimes which were, in some cases, quite unconscionable, horrible, deserving of punishment by anybody's standards. But they committed them at times in their lives when they were very much teenagers and acting like children and acting impulsively and acting differently than certainly they became later on as they morphed into adulthood. That's really what I came away with in a big way.
Well, you know, I had no intention of writing this book 5 years ago when I first met these men. But that's where I ended up going because I'm a reporter. And what I realized the first time I went inside San Quentin to do a story for National Public Radio about California's prisons was I was accidentally put in a room inside San Quentin with to wait for the public information officer. And I was afraid. It was my first time in prison. I was kind of hoping that the prisoners inside would be shackled and guards at either elbow. But when he put me in that room alone and I had to wait for him, I thought the door was locked. But the door opened and four men came in first. And they sat down with me and they had blues on. And that means that they've committed a murder. So I thought that was it. You know, once
you were terrified. It comes across in the narrative.
Yeah. But where does that terror come from in our minds? That was the question. Why? I just assumed that someone who's in prison for murder has to be kept behind these walls, those walls, because
A rash assumption. I mean, they've been tried. They've been convicted.
Exactly. They've done it.
Yeah.
They have done the worst thing any human being can do to another human being, which is to take their life. But the presumption was in my mind that if they had access to me without guards, without guns, they would try to kill me. That's the once the murderer, always a murderer in our mind, in my mind. And they didn't. But I thought they were talking.
Well, you're here.
Code, exactly. I survived the moment.
But they also accepted you. And this is an important part of your story. I mean, you managed to, well, you had someone from KLW who sort of helped open some doors for you because she was trusted. But then you became trusted and you became someone whom they essentially said, she's okay. And that's kind of the prison ethos. If they say you're okay, then you can talk to other prisoners and they can accept you as being not necessarily on their side, but as being fair and equitable.
Well, actually, it was a volunteer who, because, you know, San Quentin does have a number of excellent rehabilitation programs, but they're not provided by the CDCR. They're actually provided by the extensive network of volunteers, university teachers and professors that go
in. I've worked there myself as a volunteer many years ago, yeah.
Yeah. And so one of these volunteers was the first person I contacted to say, how do you even get inside a prison? I had no idea. And she said, well, if you come in, if you can get the warden to let you in, and don't upset him, because if he doesn't like you, you'll never get in again. And I thought, well, how do you upset a warden? But anyway, so I went in the first time. And she was supposed to meet me with this public information officer. But the interesting thing about prison is the prisoners have radios. So after you do your first story, they listen. They are very attuned to how did you present them, because they're concerned that you're going to present them in some sensationalist way, these vicious murders. And yes, they did a vicious crime, but now they're in prison. Maybe they've been in prison for 15, 20, 30, 40 years. And I think there's a desire on their part to be known for who they are today. But it's very – so they're anxious. When a member of the press walks into the prison, they do hold back. They don't just start talking to you. So after –
but they want to show you their humanity too, and you're – attuned to that as a reporter. I mean, this is the thing that comes across here. They want to show you, to some extent, that they're, I mean, the people you talk to, specifically the five you talk to, mm-hmm. that they've changed, that they've been rehabilitated. And in a number of cases, quite frankly, it had to do with Jesus.
Yeah. The church is big in prison. It's a very, there's Protestant, Catholic, Indian sweats. Because they're afforded them based on a U.S. Supreme Court decision. But I think one of the interesting – I mean, when you said they had changed, but that –
No, I mean they wanted to show you.
They wanted to show me that. But when you're inside prison and someone says, I've changed, it's kind of – you know, do you accept that? I mean, how do you know?
You don't.
They're in prison.
You don't.
They're still in prison.
And they may be deluding themselves. And as someone said to me years ago, they're cons, you know. So they could be
the
conning
definition.
You or conning themselves or – right. I mean, there's always that to factor in here.
Which is why it took so long. I mean, this wasn't a
– This wasn't an overnight project.
No.
No. In fact, how long did it take?
My first visit to San Quentin was on June 14th, 2007. And now it's 2012, so 5 years. And I'm still reporting on prisons.
I told you that I read your book somewhat as a polemic. That is, people deserve second chances, particularly people mm-hmm. who do reckless and idiotic things when they're young, fueled by drugs and alcohol and the impulsivity of youth and all the rest of that. Was that your attitude going into this, or were you just, again, more the reporter? Or did you believe in second chances?
I think I hadn't really thought about it. I really hadn't asked myself that question. I assumed that the system, some kind of system worked, that there was some kind of parole system, and that if you went to prison, you eventually went to a parole board, and the parole board decided whether you had changed, and then you got out, and something happened. You either succeeded or failed. But I had never really looked into, you know, parole as a process. You know, who goes to the parole board and how does it work? So that's what I started looking into. And what I discovered initially was that we in California have two parole systems. We have a determinate sentence and we have an indeterminate sentence. You know, prior to 1977, anyone convicted of a felony in the state of California from 1919 until 1977, everyone, regardless of what the felony was, served something called an indeterminate sentence. So if you could go to prison for 1 year to life or 5 years to life. But everyone had to go before the parole board to show that they had changed. And then in 1976, when Jerry Brown was governor the first time, he changed the law he signed into law something called the determinate sentencing. And that meant that only those serving murder would still go before the parole board. Everyone else convicted of any other felony would do a determinate sentence, and there would be a low term and a high term and a median term. And the judge would sentence the person based on the crime. And after they serve that time, that's it. They walk out of prison today. And Unfortunately, that has a very high recidivism rate, about between 60 and 70%. So as a result of that decision in 1976, much of the rehabilitation programs were removed from California prisons. The purpose of California prisons were no longer to rehabilitate.
They were punitive. Essentially. And you get the whole history here encapsulated of indeterminate sentences in mm-hmm. your book, and Prop 89, which led to the release of Archie Fain, a name that will go down in infamy. In fact, you mentioned that case specifically.
He was a driving force in California, the governor being granted the authority to reverse or to review, and then if the governor chose to reverse a parole board grant to a man or a woman serving life with the possibility of parole for murder. And, you know, it's funny when – not funny, actually, but when the when Proposition 89 went before the voters in 1988, that was a big year. Willie Horton. I mean,
George Bush campaign using Willie Horton, an African-American, to say, you know, this guy was released because of Dukakis, and then he went on to do more mayhem.
But he was actually serving a life without the possibility of parole. So he was a different – I mean, in California, if you're serving a life – without the possibility of parole, like the juvenile LWOP, juvenile life without parole, you never get out of prison. That's it. But in Massachusetts, they had passed this odd law that said if you were serving life without the possibility of parole, you should get a weekend furlough. You should go out into the society on the weekends.
And it was when Dukakis was governor, how well I remember, of course.
Yeah. Right. But it was passed by the legislature in Massachusetts. He signed it into law, but he held the brunt of it. And but in California in 1988, Governor Dukakis helped usher into this constitutional amendment that said, you know, if you are serving a life with the possibility of parole and you go before the parole board and the parole board finds you suitable, we'll give the governor the authority to reverse. Now, when it went before the voters, the legislative analyst office said, oh, the governor will probably never use this. But in effect, in the last 23 years, successive governors have actually reversed between 77 and 99% of all parole board suitabilities.
We're talking to Nancy Mullane, reporter, radio producer. She's also produced for KQED, we should mention, and author of a book as well as a radio documentary, Life After Murder. In fact, we've got some clips from your documentary. I want to hear a clip about one of the five men that you profile. And by the way, you know, one of the things I was surprised at was they were, especially this character named Edward Ramirez, he was very reluctant to talk to you at first, and yet we have all of their names in your book. We have also their profiles, their pictures, their histories, and so forth. Was there any difficulty getting them to be that open and out of the closet, so to speak?
I would say I was very fortunate. I'm a good reporter. And I believe they trusted me because of my reporting. The first time I met Ed Ramirez, I actually met Eddie Ramirez on the outside. Because the first time I went in, I met a man named Brian Smith. And Brian Smith had just been found suitable. And he was waiting the 150 days to find out whether the governor was going to reverse his parole. And in the end, the governor allowed Brian Smith to go home, and his parents held him. You know, he did not want to be profiled on the outside, but he continued to talk to me. And one day I got a phone call and he said, my parents are having a party for me, my freedom party. And I thought, oh boy, what can this possibly be like? So I went to his party, and when I got there, it was this amazing room and in this hotel with streamers and cake, and all these people were honoring his freedom. And it was another jump in my consciousness that people were happy. This person who had committed murder had gotten out after 24 years.
And they too were wary, the parents of you, your role was in this. Yeah.
But he walked me over across the room and introduced me, said, Nancy, meet Eddie, meet Richie. And at first they all backed off.
She's okay.
Yeah, she's okay. Talk to her.
Well, Edward Ramirez was sentenced to 15 years to life for second-degree murder, and after going before the Board of Parole hearings more than a half dozen times, he was found suitable for parole, only to have Governor Gray Davis reverse his parole. 150 days later. Here he describes watching other lifers who have been given a date.
Even with a date, I wasn't excited because there's still a potential to have it taken. I've seen it done time and time again, and I see how it destroys people when they get so excited. They're writing home. They're sending their things home. Their family is just, you know, on cloud nine. The kids are coming, you know, the wives come in, and then all of a sudden they get that letter from the governor, you know.
The fax.
Slid under the cell door, you know, your data's been reversed. And it's just that thump. I remember because I received one.
Well, there's a good deal in that cut of the kind of pain, you know, that many of these prisoners go through with their hoping that something will happen that will allow them to get out, and then it goes on and on and on. And you capture the sense of the heartbreak and particularly the family's effect, the loved ones and so forth. What you don't do, and you say this very early on in the book, is talk about the families of the victims.
Mm.
And as a reader of the book, I found that was something I wanted to know. But you made that conscious decision. Why?
I felt that there have been a number of stories that the victims' voices are being heard. And you know, the voice of the individuals who had committed these horrible crimes but were inside prison behind these walls, I felt that their voices simply were not known. I began slowly. This was not a conscious decision at the beginning of the work in 2007, nor was it a decision in 2008 or 2009. But as the work began to gather, and I realized that these men had such a story to tell about this world that we don't know, these men that we don't know. You know, there are two and a half million people in prison in the United States, and about 140,000 of them are serving life sentences. And I felt that if we don't know who these people are, then we don't know, you know, the kinds of sentences that we're implementing in the United States, the kind of sentences that people are living. And we also don't know the capacity that people who are sent to prison for murder, we don't know the capacity that they have to actually not only change, but to come back into society and contribute. And I felt that if I did one person in the book, if I did one man who committed a murder and told their story, that the book could potentially be seen as, well, I chose one good person. If I did three, kind of the same situation, that I chose three. But if I did five men, and that it would be in five different murders and five different process of that redemption, of that change, of that could give the reader, that could give America the opportunity to really sense all kinds of people who commit murder, all kinds of murders. That murder doesn't happen. It's not one kind of murder. There's not just murder. There are these moments of bad decisions that one bad decision turns into another bad decision that ultimately results in this horrible crime. And so when I started writing the book, and that was about 3 years ago, just slowly building the book, I thought, if I begin to go and talk to the families and the victims, that I would really lose the focus of this story. And I'm not saying that the victims' stories aren't important and that they haven't suffered immeasurably from these five murders. They have. But I made the decision to focus on this story because I felt that in America, it's a story we just don't know. And you know, it's possible that I know Eddie Ramirez is writing about his experience, and I believe the other men would like to write about their experiences as well, and maybe they'll include that. But and you know, I think each of the men, when they have talked to me, they've told me about the victims, they've told me about their grief, and in fact, one of the men went to the grave the day he got out of his victim and apologized and had that moment of you know, just grief. They feel tremendous grief for what they have done, and I felt that this was the book that needed to be done at this time was the stories of five men who committed the murders and who they become, so we know. And
So what do you say, for example, too? We got an email in the last hour from someone who said, this is murder. Murder needs to be punished. Otherwise, if we give people slack where murder is concerned, or we try to be understanding. In other words, you cross a line when you kill someone, and that line can never be restored. And the result is that society wants to exact or mete out its punishment. And somebody sent an email saying, no exceptions. what do you say to that, not necessarily no exceptions argument, but the idea that somehow there has to be punishment, and the punishment can be shouldn't be mollified, shouldn't be assuaged?
But we have a punishment. It's a, and I have to remind listeners, I am a reporter. You know, I'm not an advocate.
I read your book as somewhat of a polemic. I recognize and respect your reportage, and you do an exceptional job. And I know that you are a reporter in your heart and everything. But there's an argument in this book that says, like I said, if somebody commits these dreadful acts at a certain age, they're capable of changing, and the society needs to recognize that, and perhaps some would say allow them to be released after doing a long amount of time.
You know, I actually agree with the person who wrote the email. A line has been crossed. The moment that murder occurred, a line was crossed. It's the widest line there is. It's the loss of a life. And oftentimes when I look at the five men, either individually or together, I see these other people. I see not a ghost, but there's 10 people that I'm really looking at. And when you say, and it's a valid question, why did I not report on the victims? I felt that these stories were so important that, and I honor the victims in my book. And I hope, as I say in the introduction, that this gives them some answer, some peace, knowing that these men took their guilt and their grief so deeply that they have become the kinds of people that they have.
But you have this remarkable woman who called in the last hour and said her son was killed when he was 15 and killed by a 15-year-old, and now he's become, you know, a good family man, and she recognizes that he's reformed.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear other people, because I've done programs with, you know, families of victims who say, I've lost a loved one for my whole life, and there's no way that I can get that person back, and I want the person to go on the rest of their life suffering.
Well, they do, though.
Who did that?
Yeah. I really believe that these men don't wake up a day of their life where they don't feel that weight, that incredible heavy weight. It's, you know, some of us have done things in our lives that we're not proud of, and we have to wake up, and every once in a while say, oh, yeah, that horrible thing that I did. And we know that little bit of a weight, but can you imagine the weight that you carry? And I've seen it. I've spent hundreds of hours with these men, and I've seen the weight that they carry. But in terms of the punishment angle, we live in a system of laws, and I think that's what really drove my work, was how do these laws work? What kinds of sentences do we give?
And the bottom line is, in many instances, they don't work. But we're coming up on a break here, and I want to get our listeners involved in this. And our toll-free number is available to you, so feel free to join our conversation. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your phone calls and your involvement in the program. 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment or going to our Facebook page. We're talking to Nancy Mullane, her book, Life After Murder. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Journalist Nancy Mullane with us this hour took up the question in a very large way of whether murderers can be redeemed in her book, Life After Murder. Once a murderer, always a murderer, or can people change? Well, when you look at some of the research that's been done, actually, it's murderers who have the lowest rates of recidivism. But once murder is in the heart, some argue, you know, it can never be extracted. And yet, her cases, the five that she studies here, seem to prove the opposite. She follows the lives of five men convicted of murder who served long sentences in San Quentin prison before they were released. And in 2009, after the California Supreme Court ruled in the Lawrence decision, a Superior Court judge overruled the governor's reversal of Don Cronk's parole. He's one of the figures that are profiled in Nancy's book, ordered the warden of San Quentin to free him. And Nancy Mullane visited Dan at his new home, and he gave her a tour. Let's hear this cut.
Almost every night, unless it's too cold, about 6:37, I go out with PJ, the dog. He wants to sit with me. And then, of course, Kathleen comes in a little bit. She's always doing the dishes or whatever. And I'll sit sometimes till 10 o'clock. And one night she said, Don, why do you like it out here so late? And I go, I'm looking at the stars. I'm watching a plane go fly by. There's trees and I hear, you know, birds or bats or night creatures and people walk with their dogs. And it's awesome.
Sounds like a regular guy. He's free. I mean, that freedom comes across. Look at the stars and everything. I mean, it's moving to here if you take it out of the context of victims.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, the interesting thing, over the years that I have been doing this reporting from 2007 now to 2012, I began filing Public Record Act requests with the CDCR, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, which the R is now back, rehabilitation, although $250 million has been withdrawn from rehabilitation funding from the state, which is almost all the funding for rehabilitation. And I started filing these Public Record Act requests because I really wanted to know. My anecdotal experiences were showing me that these men were getting out. They seem to be doing quite well. But what were the statistics? And the CDCR didn't have them. They really didn't have how many people who were released from California prisons after doing time for murder recidivated, went back to prison. So they had to create an entire statistical body of work for me. And they did it. And I didn't get it until May 31st, 2011.
Well, I saw one statistic in your book. In fact, it's been highlighted in a number of places. Of the 100 convicted murderers in California over the past two decades, none have killed again. And my honest response to that is, how do we know?
1,000.
Pardon?
Of 1,000 men who have gotten...
Of 1,000, I'm sorry.
1,000.
Yeah. But how do we know they haven't committed murder again? We don't really know. They may not have been charged with murder or convicted again, but we don't know, do we?
Well, I think if they've committed a murder, they're watched pretty carefully.
You look at the number of people who get away with murder, and they're pretty startling, those numbers.
But I think these men, of all men and women, because women have also committed murder and gotten out of prison, but I think these individuals are so carefully monitored. In fact, you know, as I've followed the men from inside prison to outside prison, you know, I've their stories of their fear of jaywalking, because when they get out of prison on a parole, they're actually supposed to report any contact with law enforcement. And so when they, you know, one of the men was driving home one night and he picked up his brother at a bus stop. It was a horrible night, and it was a sunny night out driving home in Oakland, and he was feeling his freedom, stops at a bus stop, picks up his brother. The brother, apparently one of the women that the brother was talking to was a prostitute. And the police stopped him. And it was a horrible experience because even though he had done nothing wrong, you know, sometimes when these men and women get out of prison, the networks or the families that they leave behind are troubled. And so when they get out, and that's all they've got to go back to, is the same families or communities that they left behind, but they've changed. So it takes a while sometimes for them to actually find their way on the outside as individuals.
Well, that's a lot of the story here, and I want to get to that briefly because we want to get our callers in here too. But in fact, we did a program with some prisoners who had done time, part of our PIN program. And one of the Personal Insight Network that we've established here at KQED, and one of the prisoners who had been involved in a brawl and a fight and said I was guilty and, you know, made no bones about it. There are a lot of people, by the way, in prison who have done time or doing time who are somehow innocent, even though everything's been incontrovertibly proven. But this young man, I was very struck by what he said. He said the stigma, you know, there were people, as soon as they found out that he was an ex-con, they assumed, like, you went into jail, these guys are murderers. You had all these assumptions. So somebody finds out this guy has been in prison for homicide, and the immediate things that they project onto that person and the stigma that they have to face. Now, they're facing some very difficult challenges just because of that stigma in terms of getting jobs, in terms of reintegrating themselves in a society, not to mention the fact that many of them have been away from society for decades. So to get back into a life, a groove, many of their family members have gotten older, died, and so forth. But talk about just those struggles in general, what you discovered.
Well, I think it's overwhelming for them at first. There's one moment when Brian Smith describes having to lie down and put an ice pack on his head because it's so overwhelming, the stimulus of being outside. Imagine being inside literally four walls for 20 years and you see the same thing every day. And then you get out and suddenly there's buses and there's traffic and there's trees and there's people and children. They haven't seen children. And so then
women. In the case of women,
oh,
men.
That's a very big surprise, actually, is when they are inside, they're prepared for jobs. They study, they do everything they can to prepare for a job. And many of them get married while they're inside prison. And then they get out, and having a relationship with a woman on the outside as a girlfriend or a wife is very challenging because they have expectations. And then when you're inside, if they come to visit, it's one-on-one. The woman is everything. They have undivided attention. And then you get out and there's all these women. And I think one man said, I have to learn not to look. And
it's also very difficult for them in many cases, as you point out, to establish relationships or to find their way into relationships, but also to keep relationships.
But I found that the men that I profiled are very honest about telling if they meet a woman and they're going to date them, they tell them right up front. And one of the men in the book, Philip Seiler, I was quite surprised to find that he was dating quite a few women when he got out. He had made a decision 6 months without a serious relationship. And he said, you know, they don't seem to mind. They accept. But it is a challenge.
Well, we talked about Eddie Ramirez before. When his girlfriend, Lupe, is with him and you're talking to the two of them, you can, just from the way you construct the narrative, you can tell it's almost as if she wants to tell his story. She has empathized with it very deeply and understands what he went through. I mean, a lot of these men have been through some pretty shattering experiences in their youth, and you capture that as well, which I think is important in terms of giving a multidimensional sense of their stories. Let's bring our callers into this, and we'll begin with a caller whose son was convicted. It's Joanne from Concord. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. My son was convicted 3 years ago. He was a tennis player in high school and went to the Marines, joined in the Marines when he was almost 20 years old. He was 19 and a half. Joined the Marines, went into the Marines, was there for, got through boot camp and into training, and ended up in a place with his cousin and a two-time Iraqi war veteran. The Marines were letting him go. He had suffered an injury in Iraq and lost the front part of his frontal lobe of his brain and partial left. He was suffering PTSD. He ended up pulling a gun and killing somebody. My son and his cousin were there. At the time, there was nothing stolen. There was nothing. Nobody was robbed. They didn't go there to steal anything. But they were all convicted under the felony murder rule in California. My son would never lift a hand to anybody, but was convicted under the felony murder rule and given a sentence of life without the possibility of parole. Life without the possibility of parole. That means that he not only did not intend for anybody to die or to be killed, but that he could never be, quote, rehabilitated from and get out of prison ever for the rest of his life. And I'd like to know, there are more than him in prison for that. And I'd like to know.
For to some extent, this is where I was commenting somewhat editorially, I guess, on the where the laws are inadequate, because the circumstances that you describe are, you know, a kid who's in the wrong place at the wrong time, which is often the case.
And how do you take a child who's non-aggressive, not assertive, he was an admin in the Marines, put him in prison and say, you're worth nothing. You were serving your country. You went to serve your country in a time of war, and you were in the wrong place at the wrong time. We're putting you in prison for the rest of your life, and you never have a chance to get out.
Well, I think that's one of the things I hope my book accomplishes is that, you know, people are afraid when someone commits a crime of murder or they're involved in a crime of murder, as in the felony murder rule. So he did not commit the murder, but he was there when a felony occurred and a murder occurred at that time. So he is now found as guilty as if he had committed the crime himself. But I think these laws of juvenile LWOP or life without parole for adults, they're passed by, you know, legislators and voters because we want to be safe. We think that if someone commits a crime of murder that they can't change. And so we have to keep them locked up for the rest of their lives.
And there is an economic cost to pay, too. I mean, you get into that to some extent. What are lifers cost us? The estimates up to like maybe even a couple hundred thousand a year?
Yeah. The average cost is $50,000. But when you add on the cost of the appeals processes and the medical care, because, you know, I just went into death row last week for the first time. It's been a decade since a reporter's been on death row in California. And I was given access. And I was surprised by how many wheelchairs line the rows, the cell blocks. But, you know, I think that there's a reason why we pass these laws, because we are afraid. But what we don't know is that this is the story we don't know. We don't know who people are who commit murder 10, 20 years later when they've grown up, when they've changed. And I think if we have this information, if we understand that this secret population exists, in fact, in the United States, from 2000 to 2010, in one decade, 57,000 people were released from state and federal prisons after being convicted of first or second degree murder. But we don't know who they are. And they're out with a one.
It's the second time you've alluded to some bad record keeping. I mean, it is an ongoing problem.
With a 1% recidivism rate. So these men don't go back. These men and women don't go back. But we don't know who they are. So we pass harsher and harsher sentencing laws to try and prevent these people from getting out when they're found suitable for parole. But when they do get out, they contribute to society. Not only that, they pay taxes.
Well, let me thank the caller, and we'll go to another caller. And that's you, Neil. Hi.
Yeah, you didn't say whether the recidivism rate was any lower or higher when there was indeterminate sentencing.
Ah, yes, it was lower.
Lower?
Yes.
Ah, that's
good. It was around 40% until mid-1980s when the determinant sentencing laws actually went into effect and individuals began getting out on determinant sentencing. And if you look at the CDCR's website, you can find the data where you'll see these bell curves or these charts where the recidivism rate just jumps up. And, you know, when I first saw it, I had to blink. I found it hard to believe that there had been that intensive of an impact based on the determinant sentencing law. But, you know, Jerry Brown himself, and in fact, I was just talking to Justice Klein, who was Jerry Brown's legal affairs secretary back in 1976.
And Tony Klein?
Tony Klein. Yeah. And he's the presiding judge of the Court of Appeals for the first appellate district in California. And he said, yeah, it was a bad law.
Let me thank Neil. And I want to go to some emails here. There's some strong responses here that I'd like your reactions to, Nancy. Here's Dave in Alameda, who says, your efforts would be better spent securing rehabilitation for drug and nonviolent offenders and advocating for their parole. Society would benefit from that. But I found your willfully blind eye toward victims' families offensive, and it makes clear you are deeply misguided. Murderers should get out when their victims stop being dead.
Yeah, well, the thing is we have laws in the United States. And when a person commits a murder and they go to a court and they have a trial or they plea, there is a process. And the process says, you know, you are, based on the conditions of your crime, we are going to sentence you to life with the possibility of parole. And then there's this California Code of Regulations, and it outlines exactly what you have to do to prove to us that you have change, that you are no longer a risk to public safety. So if we have these laws and we sentence people to prison under these laws, saying we are going to, out here 15 years down the road or 25 years down the road, we're going to say, if you do all these things and you don't have any write-ups in prison, any disciplinary actions, and you
and you go, show remorse, and I mean, there are other
remorse,
criteria.
A lot of, you know, quite a bit of remorse, actually. And you go to college and you create program and you get drug and alcohol treatment and you even create drug and alcohol treatment in prison, that that you will be given a process by which we as a society will evaluate you. And if you meet that criteria, you will be given a second chance. And I think I understand the contributors' concern, that, but I also think that that's we actually live in a democracy of laws.
Let me give you some of more of that kind of concern. Christy mm-hmm. writes, I work with students who are sociopaths. Some tried killing their parents. Mm. They had absolutely no sense of wrongdoing or remorse, as it is with sociopaths. Once convicted, I think they need to stay in prison. I don't know what to do with these students in a society. Very little matters to them. I mean, this is the attitude some people have. You know, they think about some of these sensational cases of serial mm-hmm. killings and, you know, horrible carnage. And that's what they think of when they think of murderers. These are people they want to be behind bars.
But that's, you know, Shad Maruna is a professor of criminology at the Queen's College in Belfast. And I met him and spoke to him. And he said that, you know, we don't, because we don't know, we don't have a face of an individual who commits murder. You know, we formulate these ideas of who people who commit murder are. There's, I come back to that one image of a murder is a murder is a murder. But in my book, Life After Murder, each of the men gives great detail to their the crimes that they committed. And I think it's important because if you know the crime, if you know what the person did, Shad Maruna, who studies the punitive natures of society, says that, you know, if you know someone who committed a murder, or you know a story of someone, you know the details, you can see, oh, I can see how my cousin Joe or the guy I went to college did that, so I know how Joe can change. Then, or you read the story of how someone committed a crime and how they can, they have the potential to change, that the punitiveness of the individual drops.
Well, give us an example, if you would, from the five narratives of how one of them or a couple of them were convincing to the parole boards that they had changed or that they deserved parole or they warranted parole.
Well, I think actually, you know, all five of them were able to convince the parole board that they had changed because of the extensive work they had done inside prison. For example, Philip Seiler. He not only worked with juveniles who were brought into the prison, he created programs. He worked on a restorative justice program inside San Quentin, a restorative justice program that brought victims into the prison to meet with the individuals who committed their crimes. Because what they found with restorative justice is if you bring the victim and the perpetrator together, that the victim is able to, or the surviving victim is able to ask the person who committed the crime questions, to get answers. And they find that in that meeting that there's a humanity that takes place. There's a healing that actually occurs so that the person who's the surviving victim can move on with their life. And it doesn't work for everyone. But what they found is it's a very powerful sense of peace that can come to someone. And I think it gives the person who committed the crime the opportunity to say how sorry they are. Because what we're talking about here are human beings. We're talking about people who did a horrible thing. We've discussed in this show, is like the worst thing you can possibly do. But then you have to continue to live. You are alive. Your victim is no longer there, but you are alive. And what do we do then? What do we do with these individuals? So we've come up with these laws that say, okay, we're going to give people who have not committed, you know, sociopathic crimes of murder, we're going to give these people who have these, like Philip Seiler, it was a crime of passion. He shot and killed the person who was a drug dealer who was providing drugs to his wife and having an affair with his wife, who had threatened him with a gun. And one day they met and he felt he was threatened by this man and he shot him. Now, that was, and he drove home, called the police, and was arrested immediately. 20 years later, this is the man that the parole board saw And that's who we don't know. Our, you know, Frank Zimmering is a wonderful
professor. Been on the show many times. Yeah.
Professor at UC Berkeley. And he says, you know, we sentence people when we're angry and hurt and we're in pain. And then 10, 15, 20 years later, after the dust has settled, we don't go back. We don't go back to find out who they've become. And I think that's who the parole board sees. That's who the parole board is finding suitable for parole.
And is the person who has changed, you mean?
The person who has changed, the adult, the man who has accepted responsibility, has taken himself to the deepest, darkest place of his own potential for that, and then addressed that in himself and has come to this quite extraordinary place that we are not even aware of. And that's one of the things we're missing in American society is we don't know what redemption really looks like.
Let me bring another caller on. Jack, join us.
Yeah. So while it's the stargazing, the, what I'm trying to understand is if you were in the victim's place and it was you that lost someone to murder, and I'm not talking about the poor woman's son who just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, or even the person that killed the drug dealer. I'm just talking about just some jerk who killed somebody. Would that change your perspective at all?
Are you asking if it would change my perspective?
I think that's what
he was asking.
Yeah, that's what
sometimes I'll wake up and I'll think, you know, these men committed crimes of murder. And then I think, what if it was someone that I had loved? What if it was someone that they had killed, someone I was someone dear and precious to me? And I have to ask my, and I've searched myself in those moments because I realize I'm writing this book. I'm going to be telling the reader that these people have changed. And so I have had to, you know, and I have to admit to myself, okay, say 20 years ago, you know, someone I loved was killed. And now I find out that this person who committed that crime has been locked up in a cell so that if I put my arms out to the side, I can touch the walls. And if I put my hands up, my hand to the top of the ceiling, I can touch the ceiling. And they've been locked in that cell for 20 years. And while they've been locked in that cell, they have done deep rehabilitation work on themselves. They've taken responsibility for the crime that they committed of the person I loved. And now, if I know that on the outside, that they have been found suitable and they're living their life on the outside and they're contributing in kind of an extraordinary way. Two of the men that I have been reporting on for the last 5 years, not only are they out doing work that is very positive, but they are actually being paid by the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation to go inside the youth facilities to meet with young men who committed similar crimes, to show them and to work with them in programs that change is real.
That prompts me to ask you whether you saw any programs in San Quentin that actually help people transition out or help them rehabilitate.
Oh, there's a number of programs. There's Trust, Teaching Responsibility, Utilizing Social Tools. There's Impact, Incarcerated Men Putting Away Childish Things. And then there's this one program called where the men, the Addiction Recovery Program, where the men got so frustrated because, as Warden Robert Ayers at San Quentin told me when I first went in, you know, 90% of the men that you're going to meet inside this prison, which are anyone I wanted to meet, so 5,000 men, are there because of drug or alcohol-related crimes. They were either using or they were buying or selling. And so these men that I met inside San Quentin that are lifers, considered lifers, life with the possibility of parole, they got so frustrated that they weren't getting the kind of attention they needed for their drug and alcohol-related crimes that they actually met with this volunteer and asked her to bring educators into the prison to teach them how to become certified drug and alcohol counselors so they could not only learn about it themselves, but then they became certified counselors by the state of California to provide counseling to other inmates. But on the outside, so they've now brought.
It's difficult for them often to get even access, isn't it?
Well, they, you know, it was kind of a moment in California history when Alcoholics Anonymous was brought into San Quentin. But as the men have told me, you know, there's a limit to how much we want. They wanted the actual education. They wanted to understand the physiology of addiction. And so they took the coursework. And in fact, when they took the state exam, they passed the exam at a higher rate than counselors and therapists who take it on the outside. And I was there the day they were told that they had passed. It was quite an amazing day.
Nancy Mullane, reporter, radio producer, author, creator of the book and the radio documentary, Life After Murder. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Yeah, and tonight the book is launching at Electric Works.
Well, you beat me to it here. Good for your own PR. Yeah, the book is launching at Electric Works. That's over at 1350 Mission Street. From 6 to 9, opening exhibit of photography of five men in the book. I'm actually looking at their pictures here.
Elizabeth Fall is the photographer.
And tomorrow night, Nancy Mullane will be at Books Incorporated, which is over on 4th Street in Berkeley at 7 p.m., book signing and talk with one of the men. And if you're up listening to us in Seattle, she'll be up at Kep there July 8th to 10th. I don't know how long we want to stretch this, but also at Kepler's Books in Palo Alto, July 24th. Book Passage, Corte Madera, July 25th. And Alcatraz, August 25th through November 17th. You're going to be there that whole time?
I'm going to be there
on
Saturday.
Are we doing time at Alcatraz? No.
It's a nice – the photographs will be on display for 3 months of the man.
And City Arts and Lectures, October 30th. I think we get your whole schedule
thank you
here
so
for the
much.
Rest of the year almost. Thank you so much for being with us. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, and Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.